This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 112 was recorded April 5th, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. Variant Perception Managing Editor Simon White joins me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss the equity market outlook, U.S. dollar, Treasury yield curve, LIBOR OIS spread, Canadian macro outlook, China LEIs, Japan, and much, much more. Be sure to stay tuned after the feature interview when Patrick and I will return for extended equity market coverage in our postgame segment, and we'll also discuss the inflation versus deflation debate as a follow-on to my interview with Simon White.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500 seemed to have almost double bottom retested earlier in the week, and we've got a pretty strong bounce here, and I'm sure many of our listeners are asking the question of whether that was it. What's your thinking here on equities?
Well, there is an argument that that was it. So let's make that argument first, although, frankly, I'm not buying it myself. What you could do is look at, say, an hourly chart and look at the top of the bounce where we hit 2,800, and you see a pretty darn clear downward sloping trend line. And sure enough, we broke through it yesterday afternoon on Wednesday, and we've moved well above it. And to the quick eye, it appears in many ways that, okay, the recovery is on. It's all happening. And that's pretty much the end of the bull case as far as I see it. There are several reasons that I don't think that that's really what's happening. And the reason I say that is, first of all, we haven't seen the kind of volume follow through that I would expect. This move higher, as far as I can tell, the catalyst was Larry Kudlow. Now, I don't understand this, Patrick. Nobody ever took Larry Kudlow seriously when he was on CNBC. Now he's in the White House and he says, ready for this wisdom of inspiration, folks? There's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And based on that economic insight, it looks like it triggered a short squeeze in the S&P, took us up pretty substantially in price. But from a volume standpoint, I don't see anything close to the volume follow through that I would expect if that really was the final bottom. More to the point, as we discussed on the program last week, you don't usually have epic pivotal levels in stock markets where first that level, you get a chance to buy it, and then you get a week-long grace period and a bunch of more chances to buy it. What we saw last week was the bottom was right around the 200-day moving average, or 2589 or so, and I said I think it's still got lower to go. This week, the number was about 20 points lower, maybe 25 points lower at around 2560, and again, I don't think this is the final bottom. The reason that I say that is if we get to the final bottom, I would expect the smartest money to know that the bottom is in and they start buying like crazy and we see a big rally with a lot of volume follow through on it. And we haven't seen that yet. We've seen a big point rally, 100 points actually, more than 100 points, but we haven't seen the volume there. Furthermore, we saw two opportunities to buy that 2560 level. It gave it to you once on Monday and then again on Wednesday. It doesn't feel to me like this is over. But most importantly, Patrick, you and I both agree that there is a magic number below this market, down around 2535. That's only about 30 points lower than we've been so far, where we think all hell is going to break loose if that number is tested and we think it's going to get there. Okay, drum roll. Why do we think that? The answer is too long and involved for our market wrap, so we're going to save it for the post-game segment. Be sure to stay tuned after the feature interview with Simon White when Patrick and I will be back to talk in detail about why 2535 on the S&P could be the point where a whole bunch of selling occurs, and I think that we're going to get there. We'll describe why as we get into our post-game segment.
All right, well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar index, because quietly this is creeping right up to the top end of its two-month range, up at around the 90.5 level, and it's almost teasing for a breakout. And when you go to individual major cross-currencies like the U.S. dollar against the yen, we already have a breakout. Is this going to happen? Are we going to see a big U.S. dollar surge here?
Well, you know, I keep reading people declaring about how just ominously horrible the situation is for the U.S. dollar as we break to new highs. That's been the trend for a few weeks here. Maybe they're looking at a different chart pattern than I am, but I don't see any real technical indication that says the bottom's about to fall out on the U.S. dollar. Could be wrong, but for now, it looks to me like it's bouncing, and I've seen a lot of good arguments. It's one, I want to save the conversation for our post-game segment when we have the time to get into it, but our good friend Russell Napier had an article out this week also making one of the strongest cases that I've seen for why the dollar should actually appreciate from here. So I hate to fade someone I respect as much as Juliet de Klerk. She is still dollar bearish. We do have her scheduled, by the way. She was not available this month, but the end of next month, we've got her scheduled, and I'm very much looking forward to getting her to expand on her views. But for now, as far as I'm concerned, it's edging higher. I'm not going to fight the trend. I certainly don't want to be short. I definitely have a very bearish short view on the U.S. dollar in the long term, but I see lots of reasons that we could see a short squeeze and or a interest rate differential driven push to higher values on the U.S. dollar in the short to intermediate term. So long term, I see the bearish argument very clearly. Short to intermediate term, jury's out as far as I'm concerned, and I'll definitely be asking Simon White for his views as well.
All right. Well, I've been waiting all week to ask you about crude oil because we seem to have come off of that, what appears could be a double top of testing that 66 upper boundary. But yet we haven't really seen any selling that opened the floodgate to the downside. It's almost like we're stuck at this moment where it could go either way. Do you have a bias as to how oil's going to play out here?
Well, not just that, Patrick, but we also saw the bounce come right off the critical level of 62. That's where the upsloping trend line that had formed the bottom of that triangle pattern in the daily chart has been. That was the number that we needed to break below to really confirm any kind of bearish view. And we've seen a pretty firm rejection from that this week. So far, we're still in limbo. As our long-term listeners know, my view previously had been that WTI should have had a bearish resolution to that triangle and broken down towards a price target around $55 or so. Everything changed on the morning of March 16th. I believe that is when the news first was leaked confidentially to insiders that John Bolton was going to become the next national security advisor. And of course, that sparked a big rally in both crude oil and gold. For the moment, it seems like that Bolton shock is blowing over and people are less concerned. We're seeing both crude oil and gold selling off this week. So as far as this week is concerned, Patrick, my lower price scenario has been playing out quite nicely. We got down to key support at $62. We're bouncing off of that fairly impressively right now. Of course, it is a key support level. You'd expect at least a bounce. The big question is it a bounce that's going to eventually correct back down? Are we going to see numbers below 62? Or is that $62 support at the bottom of that channel just going to be the beginning of the next move back to the top of the channel, which, by the way, would be perfectly lined up with the target of about 67.76, which was the upside resolution target from that triangle pattern, which resolved to the upside from the daily chart. Well, Patrick, as much as I have been quite bearish previously, I've been reading up on John Bolton's history. I mean, this guy is about as much of a neocon war hawk as they come. I think if you wanted to get somebody that was more inclined to start wars, you'd have to get Paul Wolfowitz back into the cabinet. So unless this geopolitical situation heats up again, I think we're headed lower in oil prices. The thing is, I didn't see a really big risk of geopolitical situation heating up previously. Now I see it. And right now it seems like the, oh my gosh, a neoconservative guy has been added to the cabinet. Oh boy, let's panic, even though there's no particular event on the radar screen to panic over. That's blown over. So the question is, will there be a specific event on the radar screen? The most obvious answer to that question would probably come immediately after May 12th, which is the date that President Trump has given for probably backing away from the Iran nuclear deal. What happens in terms of reimposition of sanctions after they do that and so forth, that's probably when it heats up again. So I'm definitely on the geopolitical watch for where there could be bullish triggers in this market. I think in terms of the trends that we're seeing in inventory and so forth, things are favorably changing, except for exports. I'll come back to that in just a minute. But boy, the war risk, the geopolitical upset risk is definitely getting my attention. And of course, today we saw the White House come out alluding to forthcoming sanctions against Venezuela, and that doesn't help the picture either. So I'm definitely starting to see a scenario for higher prices, but it really depends on how this geopolitical sentiment situation plays out, and anything could happen there. As far as the downside action that we had, it really was testing the bottom of the channel right at that critical $62 level. And then we got a bullish surprise on inventory. So API, the private service that reports on Tuesday afternoon, had reported inventory that people thought was fairly bearish. Then when the EIA data came out against an expectation of a build on national crude oil inventory of about 2 million barrels, we got a 4.6 million barrel drawdown. So that's what, a 6.5 million barrel miss? That's a pretty darn big miss in terms of inventory, not quite meeting up with expectations. The thing, though, was Cushing, Oklahoma, that very, very critical place where the West Texas Intermediate Crude Oil Futures contract is settled. Cushing saw a build of 3.7 million barrels, almost as big as the national drawdown. Gasoline drawing down 1.1 million barrels, distillates building 537,000 barrels. Production this week, again, up another 27,000 barrels to 10.46 million, new all-time record in terms of U.S. production. Remember, 20,000 barrels per week, if that is sustained week over week, would translate to a million barrels a year. So 27,000 barrels this week, 26,000 barrels last week. We're basically increasing production. If sustained for the course of a full year, which I think is quite likely at the current rate, we're looking at an extra 1.3 million barrels of U.S. production over the next year. That's a lot. So you've got to ask yourself, what the heck is going on that we had a period of really big Cushing drawdowns, even as national inventory was building? Now it seems like the situation has reversed to getting really unseasonal drawdowns nationally in crude oil, even when Cushing is finally starting to rebuild very impressively. The answer is there are two very specific reasons for both of those. As far as Cushing rebuilding its inventory, a lot of this has to do with the full operation of the Keystone Pipeline, supplemented by the beginning of rail exports. People are finally arbing that big price spread between Western Canadian Select and WTI. And the way they're doing that is by rail shipments out of Canada for the United States. That's helping to replenish Cushing. Well, you say, wait a minute, if more imports are coming in from Canada, and that is clearly showing up in the Cushing numbers, how could those national numbers possibly be showing a drawdown? The answer is exports have exploded to above 2 million barrels per day, 2.175 to be specific. That equates to 15.2 million barrels on the week of exported oil. And remember, just a little over a year ago, it was illegal to export crude oil. That would have meant that our 4 million barrel drawdown would have been about an 11 or 12 million barrel build on inventory. What's happened is, and I believe it was the very first one last week, the Louisiana offshore oil port is starting to fuel VLCCs, that's very large crude carrier tankers, the very biggest crude oil ships that carry huge amounts of crude oil into the United States. Previously, we had never used those really big ships to export U.S. crude oil. Now, through the Louisiana offshore oil port, they're actually fueling and shipping VLCC cargoes out of the United States. I don't know if this is going to be a new trend. I'm trying to learn more about this myself. But if it is, if we're going to start to export with VLCCs, we're really going to draw down U.S. inventories. And even though the smartest people will see that this is a shell game, we're moving the oil around. It's still there. It's just going someplace else. The thing is, if it comes out of U.S. inventory, it comes out of the most visible statistics in the world. It's going to help price. And there's no doubt in my mind, Patrick, that there are some invisible hands here who want to see the price higher, who are doing everything they can to coax this situation along. So we really need to watch this. If VLC exports from the Louisiana offshore oil port are to continue, we could see an explosion of exports of U.S. light sweet crude oil out of the United States, and that could really have an upside impact on prices. With regard to this week's inventory, the market could not decide what to make of it, and it was very interesting price action. First of all, as we've seen for the last few weeks, frankly, there was a really big move, a good 15 or 20 seconds before the data officially came out, suggesting that somebody's getting the data early. We've seen signs of that in the last few weeks. It was more apparent this week. Once it moved, though, obviously with that massive miss on expectations, 4.6 million barrel draw versus expectations of a 2 million barrel build, that was a rocket up in crude oil prices. To my astonishment, Patrick, it retraced within 5 minutes fully back to where it was before the data came out. And I looked at that and I thought, holy cow, if this market is going to shrug off that big of a miss on expectations, it really wants to go down. So I was bracing for a break to the downside. I guess the market must have thought it through or taken a second look or something and said, no, that miss is just too big. And it really took off from there. But it was only after that retrace has happened, which really surprised me. And of course, it moved up more than a dollar in the next day or so. And we were down. It looked like moving substantially lower today until news came out about pending sanctions against Venezuela, which resulted in a spike up of more than a dollar. That retraced fully. And we've been in a seesaw motion ever since. So I think this market is trying to figure out what to do next. The big question is, do we break below 62? I think we eventually will, unless the geopolitical situation heats up. And I think that there is a much larger chance of that happening than I was previously discounting.
All right. Well, let's move on to gold, because over the last 2 weeks, we saw two attempts for gold to beat the 1350 level. The 52-week highs are closer to 1365, each time teasing the gold bugs like it wants to make that rip to 1400, but hitting headwinds every time. What's your take here on gold?
Well, I think that the big move up in gold was all about geopolitical fears and John Bolton and so forth. That has blown over, at least in terms of perception, for now. And that's the reason that I think we're seeing the sell-off. We're looking at 1329 as we're speaking right around the close on Thursday. I wouldn't be surprised if it starts to work its way back down toward that key support level at about 1308. The thing is, the geopolitical fears have blown over for now, and I think we've probably got a little grace period that it's unlikely that Bolton and Trump are going to start any more rhetoric about what they're going to do with Iran next until after this deadline of May 12th has come and gone. Thing is, what happens after that, Patrick, and what does the market do to start to anticipate it well in advance? I wouldn't be surprised if, as that date approaches, we start to see more geopolitical premium built into the price of gold. And of course, the other thing is the dollar index. Everybody was, I think, expecting the dollar was headed south, and that was a good reason to buy gold. Now we're seeing strength in the dollar that a lot of people never expected. That's creating a headwind for gold. The geopolitical force will be a larger tailwind than the dollar headwind is when it comes back. But right now, it appears to be out of investors' minds.
All right. Well, let's move on to the 10-year treasury yield, because we came into the week trading at the bottom end of the range around 272. And since then, we've picked up about 10 basis points up towards 283. Where are yields going from here?
Well, I think the really important thing to observe here is the short squeeze that we feared in the treasury market, or maybe we didn't fear it. Maybe we looked forward to it as an opportunity to get better location on a short treasury trade. Depends on how you look at that one, I guess. But the short squeeze that we thought might be starting last week, it's not starting. At least it's not starting right now, because we're going the other way. I still think that because of the positioning that exists in the short treasury trade, that there's plenty of room for that that short squeeze to happen, but it's not in play right now. Two spot 60 is going to be the key level. If that starts to break, it's going to really cause a lot of people who are short to panic out of their positions, and you could see a very substantial pop lower in yields, higher in prices from there. Simon is going to have plenty to say on this, so why don't we save the rest for the feature interview?
All right. Now, also, you were mentioning that Saturday night is going to be fight night in the cryptocurrency world. What's going on?
Well, I don't know about fight night. You know, everybody seems to want to think that there needs to be this evil knockout, takedown, dragdown, smackdown fight of a debate on this crypto thing. Fortunately, my friend Preston Pish over at the Investors Podcast shares my view that a grown-up, polite discourse as opposed to a debate is a much more interesting conversation. And he found the perfect guy for it. I didn't know Tor de Meester before this came up, but Preston was kind enough to set this, let's not call it a debate per se, let's call it a passioned discourse on cryptocurrency. I'm taking a bearish view, and it's very interesting because Tor is a very smart guy. He understands the technology well. He understands all of the limitations of the proof of work model and the technical problems that exist in blockchain every bit as well as I do. Ironically, he comes to opposite conclusions than I do, which is really fascinating. So we taped this a little over a week ago, and it is going to be out on Saturday night. We don't have a link in your research roundup because it hasn't been published yet, but we will certainly, if you follow us on Twitter, you can either follow me or follow Macro Voices. We will tweet that link as soon as we receive it from the Investors Podcast on Saturday evening.
Thanks for the summary, Eric. Now, this week's featured interview guest is Variant Perception Managing Editor Simon White. Eric's interview with Simon White is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Simon White, Managing Editor at Variant Perception. Simon has prepared an excellent chart book for our listeners. You can find the download link in your Research Roundup email. Simon, I think the question on everybody's mind is, we're speaking Thursday morning, actually, just before the market opens, so we're one session behind the listeners in terms of market history. Are we at the end, maybe, of a correction that's perhaps played out, or are we maybe at the beginning of something much bigger in terms of equity markets? What do you guys see on the horizon?
Hi, Eric. Thanks for having me on the show. Yeah, that's an excellent question, and one, unsurprisingly, we've been getting from many of our clients. I think the lead into this market is extraordinary. You know, I mean, last year we had virtually no bears left. Everyone was no doubt tempted in by a market that had like 202 consecutive days last year within 3% of an all-time high, which is obviously quite extraordinary price action. And then, you know, we had the late January, early February, we had the essentially the vol spike. We have many different players in the markets that are short vol, either implicitly or explicitly through things like risk parity. And we had this sort of mini crash. Now, once you get a crash, the market dynamics tend to change very quickly. And then you're kind of in, to some extent, uncharted territory because you have different players taking their cues off one another and you get much more volatile price action. So what we have tried to, you know, put some sort of template on what happens, we discovered a book, a really good book by a guy called Didier Sornet called Why Stock Markets Crash. Now, this guy's a geophysicist, and he applied the maths of plate tectonics to stock market crashes. And what he noted was that stock markets tend to display very similar behavior after crashes, which is what physicists call harmonic oscillation. Now, this is the sort of motion that a pendulum does. Now, if we go to the slide deck, which I think your listeners can get hold of, on slide 7 on the bottom chart there, you can see it's sort of a stylized example of what this motion looks like. And so this is like the motion of a pendulum, as I say, and you get this self-correcting force towards the center of the movement, but with declining amplitude. And what's uncanny is how previous crashes, such as in 2011 and 2015 in the S&P, and we have these charts there as well, you know, have followed this pattern. Now, generally, it lasts for, 8 to 12 weeks. And obviously, we're kind of 8 weeks into that thing, the crash was like 7 or 8 weeks ago. And what normally happens is you get a retest of the lows at some point, you know, towards the 8 week kind of horizon in that sort of total pattern that we're going through right now. And we're kind of buying on, you know, as I say, it's kind of extraordinary how similar this particular mini crash is to previous crashes. So, you know, for us, it's kind of like we're right on the precipice, if you like. This is the point where if we have just seen the lows retested in the last couple of days, and we obviously had a very strong rebound yesterday that seems to follow through in today and Thursday, as you say, Eric. And, you know, if that's something that is the lows being retested, then, we should expect to see some sort of short-term rebound because that crash pattern dynamic is over. But we're kind of right at the precipice. When I wish I had like a 100% solid answer, but when you're in a sort of highly volatile state as we are today, it's extremely difficult to know 100% for sure.
Well, great minds think alike. Your views are very similar to my own. And I guess the question it begs, let's assume that one way or another, this is a correction that, you know, it's not the end of the world. It's either we're already there or we've got maybe one more test lower, but eventually it's going to play out as a correction and start to recover. Do you think that we've got room to get to new all-time highs and market moving even higher, or do you think the top's in already?
This is the thing. I think you have to stand back a little bit. And what does one mean by a market top? And I would say this is a sort of question that applies to finance in general. It's often people use words in many different contexts. And often you find you're talking about something, but you both have a different meaning about what that particular thing means. So you realize that that's the sort of basis of your either confusion or disagreement. When it comes to top, I think still many people tend to believe it's something that happens very suddenly. And once you hit the top, the market goes straight back down. But, you know, we've looked at tops, market tops in quite a lot of detail at Variant Perception. And we actually wrote a paper a few years ago called Understanding Market Tops. And in that paper, you know, we highlight that every market top is unique, but they do share many common characteristics. But the key thing to note is that a market topping is a process and it's not a point. So it's not something that happens suddenly in time. Bottoms of markets are more like that. They tend to be a little bit more, event-like. But tops can go on for a long, long time. And I think the thing that we're seeing today is we're seeing multiple signs that the market is going through a topping process. And the previous kind of vol-driven fall that we saw in the market back in January, February, I think is part of that topping process. And, you know, some of the things that we are looking at in equities that kind of suggests us we're going through that process. You know, equities have been held up by a number of supports over the last few years. And a lot of those supports to us are looking like they're at risk. So again, if you want to go to the slide deck on slide number 8, we're looking at a number of things here. You know, we're looking at global growth looks like it's peaking. So, you know, we just put out our leading indicator watch, which is one of our monthly reports. And all the indicators that we're looking at for global growth suggest that we're very near the peak in global growth. We also have the Federal Reserve is systematically removing liquidity from markets and giving no sign it's really about to change course. You know, that's something, a dynamic as well, that the market is having to try and digest. Also, our leading indicators are unequivocally pointing to higher inflation. Another big question that we get asked a lot is about inflation. And that's something, again, you know, we try and follow our leading indicators rather than try and have an opinion and or trying to pick and choose data to try and suit what our particular view is. You know, you read a lot of people who tend to be, you know, inflationists or deflationists and tend to do that, tend to pick and choose. We just follow our indicators and they've been, as I say, unequivocally pointing to higher inflation, certainly over the last year. So in the top right chart, you can see in slide 8, you can see, for instance, we've got there the Federal New York's underlying inflation gauge clearly points to higher inflation. We also have our own leading indicators also pointing to higher inflation. Higher inflation, though, is the enemy of price earnings multiples. So if you look at the bottom left chart, and that's a chart going back to, you know, the 1920s, you can see that higher inflation tends to lead to lower price multiple, certainly a lower Kate ratio. And, you know, that's something, again, that's been holding the market up for most of the last few years. You know, price earning multiples are responsible for over half of S&P returns over the last 5 years, which is much higher than normal periods. Furthermore, you've got profit margins. You know, profit margins are coming under pressure. Again, you know, we use our leading indicators here. We have our wages leading indicator that has consistently pointed to higher U.S. wages over the last year, year and a half. And we're really beginning to see that slowly feed through. But very intuitively, you take that wages leading indicator, you invert it, and you push it forward by almost 2 years, which you can see in the bottom right-hand chart. That tends to lead corporate profits. And, you know, again, it makes perfect sense. You know, wages are the biggest single expense that companies have. And that is clearly pointing to much lower profit margins over the next 2 years. So we're really seeing all these sort of fundamental supports for equities falling away. And at the same time, you know, markets are getting used to, you know, they're getting used to higher rates. They're getting used to things like much more exaggerated trade tensions. And they're having to get used to these fundamental supports starting to fall away. So, you know, we see that the market is in a topping process. Now, that doesn't stop the, you know, the possibility that we get a further subsequent high after today. But it does mean that the environment is much more difficult for equities. And it also means that people are going to have to get used to much higher volatility, which means your risk reward essentially for going long is much lower, because you could suddenly get caught on the wrong side of another move that we saw like in February, but perhaps even more severe. You know, the reason why February's move, I think, was contained was because a lot of the people who are implicitly short vol, so take like your risk parity guys, you know, they kind of have to react to realized volatility, not so much implied volatility. And that kind of operates with a bit of a lag. If the correction had been sustained more than 10% and perhaps lower than 10%, they would have had to de-risk even more than what they did. And then you would have got this cascade effect and a much deeper market downturn. So it kind of feels like we got like a little bit away with it back in February, but these dynamics are still there. And, you know, these are the risks that the market still potentially faces.
I want to come back to something that you said a minute ago, which is the Fed is continuing to reduce its balance sheet, destroying U.S. dollars, reducing the supply of them, while at the same time, other central banks are increasing the supply. It seems so clear to me, and our friend Russell Napier had a piece on this recently, if you're reducing the supply of U.S. dollars, I would think that that would be dollar bullish. But we're seeing so many people coming out in the last few weeks with these dollar bearish calls. Where do you guys see this, and how do you reconcile these various different forces that people are talking about affecting the dollar index?
Again, another question that we've been asked a huge amount of times lately, and it's something that obviously is super important. You know, if you get the direction of the dollar right, if you're an international investor investing in many different currencies, that can contribute a huge amount to your overall return. So it's a very interesting question, because there's a number of differing views about it just now, but also it's a very important question when it comes to looking at you know, one's portfolio. We were bearish on the USD for most of 2017. But now, principally due to the oversoldness, we've turned medium-term bullish. You know, that's obviously been a tough call, because we turned, you know, as I say, towards the end of last year, and the dollar has had a bit of a torrid time. But we're sticking to that call. Now, I think this is what's happened. Towards the end of last year, many people began to upgrade their forecasts for the US on the back of tax stimulus. But that meant that the outlooks for other countries were revised up too. You know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. But with a beta of more than one. And that meant the other currencies began to rally more than the dollar, which paradoxically meant the dollar was weakening in response to a stronger US economy. And you can actually see this relationship if you go to slide 9 in the deck. It's very elegantly illustrated in the chart in the bottom left-hand side, which is when many PMIs of countries around the world are in expansion, the dollar tends to weaken, and vice versa when more of these PMIs start to fall. But what does this mean today? Well, it means that anything that's a risk to global growth is a potential boost for the dollar. And you can see this in the top chart on that slide. You know, global growth, ex-US, tends to be much more volatile and fluctuate with a greater amplitude than US growth. You know, and as I mentioned earlier, we have our lead indicator watchman out today. You know, we see global growth as peaking. And to add to this, we've got these trade tensions. And if you look at global exports versus global growth, you can see a very clear link. You know, when global trade starts to fall, that's very bad for global growth. Now, you know, at the minute, the US and China have agreed to tariffs, you know, $100 billion of goods in total. But even if only some of this is passed through, this is a sizable chunk, you know, out of global trade. And this is something that perhaps sort of makes sense to these guys. You know, that's a political scientist, Edward Stuckback, said that, you know, trade wars are the, you know, the logic of conflict in the grammar of commerce. And that's kind of what we're seeing played out today. But what happens, interestingly, is it seems that whenever we get like a bad trade headline, is the dollar knee-jerk reaction tends to weaken. in response to these headlines. But, you know, history points in the opposite direction. Because you look at the bottom right-hand chart in that slide, it clearly shows that falls in global trade are often accompanied with a stronger dollar. And that's why we think that is, that basically when you get declines in global growth, it tends to hurt the rest of the world more than the US, which means that their currencies tend to fall more than the dollar, which obviously means the dollar tends to rally. So that's something we foresee, you know, and certainly in the medium term. Longer term, I think the dollar is still overvalued. You know, I think if you're looking out into, you get a significant rally in the dollar, if you look at the longer term valuation measures for the dollar, such as purchasing power parity, you know, almost all currencies are, you know, undervalued versus the dollar. And also, if you look at things like the real effective exchange rate, the dollar still has, on a longer term basis, the dollar still has a very strong real effective exchange rate. So I think longer term, you still have to be dollar bearish. But many of the things we see today are pointing to, you know, a stronger dollar.
Simon, there's an aspect of this I want to ask you about because it perplexes me. There's a lot of very famous people, Jeff Gundlach is one of them, who have predicted two things, both much higher U.S. Treasury yields and much lower U.S. dollar relative to other currencies. Now, the common wisdom in macro always used to be that as your Treasury rates are appreciating or are getting more competitive with other countries, that forces international flow into your currency and attracts more money from international markets and the currency appreciates. Usually, this inverse relationship is kind of an emerging markets thing that doesn't happen in developed markets where you have the currency declining even as the Treasury yield is increasing. Has something fundamentally changed that's leading all these people to a prediction that kind of doesn't jibe with what the old school religion of macro is, or am I missing something?
Again, that's a good question. And I think there's a very strong link between the dollar, but more specifically, rather than just yields, the link that we have noticed is between the link between dollar and, you know, the yield curve. So, you know, interestingly, you know, you look at previous instances or longer term correlations between the dollar, you know, it's the things you might expect, like Fed funds rate have sort of high correlations, or it might be, you know, gold or commodities. But what's unusual about the last year is the extreme link or high correlation between the dollar and the yield curve. And again, we've shown that on slide 10 of the deck that you've got there. You know, that this correlation is now almost one right now, if you look at on a one-year rolling basis, which, you know, we've got the chart come back there to 1985, which is, I think, about as far back as we could actually take it. That's an all-time extreme. So we have this dynamic with the yield curve being extremely correlated to the dollar. And obviously, we've had this situation that the yield curve has generally been flattening, and the dollar has generally been weakening. But what's interesting about this chart is that when you get these extremes in correlations, you know, as we've got today, but even more so, that tends to correspond with, you know, pullbacks in the dollar. So, you know, that's something, again, that we're perhaps expecting to see today. But I think, you know, even more interestingly is the real yield curve. You know, again, that's something that tends to be looked at less often, but I think it can give you very interesting information. You know, I think when the Fed is trying to raise rates, and it's trying to raise rates ahead of inflation, so obviously it's trying to get the real yield at the short end of the curve higher. What they also want to see is not only that longer yield's going up, but they want the longer real yield to go up. That's a very good situation for them to be in. So that means that the real yield curve is steepening, because essentially the market's saying, that's great, you're raising rates at the front and the end, so we're seeing stronger real yields, and the longer term rate of growth is not being hampered by that. So the market's given it a kind of thumbs up to say you're not going to screw growth up further down the line. So the real yield curve has kind of been quite well behaved lately. You know, it's flattened a little bit over the last year, but you know, this year it's, if anything, slightly steepened. And you can see the relationship between the real yield curve and the dollar on the bottom right hand chart. And that tends to, again, support our view that the dollar is medium-term supported. So that's something, again, that fits in with that longer-term view. I think when you've got to be worried is when you see the real yield curve flatten and flatten significantly. That's something I think will be a very kind of ominous sign for the state of U.S. growth.
And where do you see it going? It looks like, as I look forward to slide 11 here, you see a steepening of the yield curve. So it sounds like you don't think a yield curve inversion or recession is immediately on the near horizon, at least.
It's not on the near horizon. What basically our view in the yield curve is that I think that we're past the flattening phase. We've been flattening for 4 years, and it's going to have a steepening bias. Now, that's not to say it's going to suddenly steepen very aggressively. I think we need to see a recession before we get that, and, you know, and the Fed having to rapidly reverse course before you get anything extreme like that. Now, I know that the yield curve is often seen as a great recession indicator, and it is. You know, it really is. I mean, if you had like a desert island, you could only take one leading indicator. If you were so unlucky that you're only allowed to take leading indicators, you would take the yield curve. You know, it's the single best kind of leading indicator. And when it inverts, I think there's been one false positive, which is 1967, that didn't point to a recession. But the problem with the yield curve is that the lags involved. So when it inverts to when you get the recession, it could be anything from 6 months to, you know, 2.5 years. So I think there's much better things that you can use to try and predict recession. So what we've done at Verint Perception is we've built a recession signal. And that kind of was like one of the early kind of founding reasons, if you like, for us trying to build this business. As well, you know, economists are very smart people, but they seem to miss a bunch of stuff. And one of the things that they seem to systematically be unable to do was to predict recessions. And that's obviously something when in markets is extremely important to get right. So we spent a lot of time in this. You know, we built a number of recession models. The signal is actually in the slide deck in one of the earlier slides. I think it's slide 5. And it really tries to capture the kind of the sudden movement that an economy moves from a non-recessionary state to a recessionary state. So whenever anyone reads or whenever you read someone has upped their probability of recession from 45% to 50%, and I would take that with a grain of salt, because economies don't linearly move from a non-recessionary state to a recessionary state. They tend to do so in a much more binary fashion, a bit like a kind of phase transition. Again, you know, going back to physics, you know, when a pot of water, you know, is boiling, the water doesn't gradually change from water to steam. It gets up towards 100 centigrade, and then there's this thing called a phase transition, and it moves into steam. And recessions are very much a similar kind of thing. And so our recessionary signal is something that we're going to rely on to try and for us to try and predict the next US recession. We're able to use that real time in the last recession back in January 2009 to tell our clients that the US was already in recession. But going back to the, you know, the yield curve, you know, I think where we are today, and as I say, I try not to get mixed up in whether an inversion is going to happen for a recession. You know, it's neither a necessary nor a sufficient sign for a recession to happen. But, you know, we're clearly seeing that longer yields are biased higher. And in slide 11, we have our fair value model for US. Now, that's not a prediction of where we expect 10-year yields to go. But the interesting thing to look at there is when the gap's very large. And then it gives you what the direction of travel is likely to be. And that kind of feels like, again, you know, where we are today. I mean, yields had plenty of opportunity earlier in the week for bonds to essentially to rally much more than they did when the market was selling off, but they didn't. You know, it's clearly, it feels like we're in a new regime now. And the way we're looking at that in terms of the yield curve is the chart in the top right. There's a very, very strong link between fixed income volatility and between the yield curve. So rises and falls in fixed income volatility tend to match rises and falls in the yield curve. Now, again, we've been in this extremely low volatility environment over the last few years, and that's coincided with this, you know, essentially relentless flattening of the yield curve. But now, again, you know, fixed income volatility got to an all-time low last year and has begun to pick up. And at the same time, we saw a pickup in the yield curve. And again, you know, the yield curve flattened again, of course, over the last, you know, over the last week or two. But I think it's going to be easier to be on the steepening side of this trade now than the flattening trade. And the real key to sort of why this is all likely to happen is, you know, why is fixed income volatility likely to pick up? Well, not only the fact it was super low and it'd be much harder for it to go much lower. If you look at the bottom right-hand chart on slide 11, we have the Fed now trying to reduce its balance sheet. And what we can see from that chart is when the volatility of changes in the size of the Fed's balance sheet rises, that tends to coincide with rises of fixed income volatility. So now, as I say, we have the Fed actively reducing its balance sheet. We're much likely to see higher volatility in its balance sheet, and that will coincide with higher fixed income volatility, which will mean a steeper yield curve.
Going back to the 2008 event, one of the indicators that a lot of really astute investors looked at was the Treasury Euro-Dollar spread, or the TED spread. It seems like these days the new buzzword is LIBOR OIS. So what is the difference between the TED spread and the LIBOR OIS spread? And in particular, you know, they're both measures of the health of the banking system. As I look at slide 12 on the left side of the page, you've got a graph of LIBOR OIS. I mean, it really looks like it's blowing out in a pretty dramatic way. Is that a major warning sign, and what does it point to in terms of what's coming?
The short answer is that it is a warning sign, but not in the way people, I think, expect it to be a warning sign. So you mentioned 2008, you know, we're not there today. Back then, it was LibreOS was widening, was all about a demand issue. People had stopped lending, and there was a scramble for offshore dollars. And that's why LIBOR really started to soar, and it went way, way higher than it's going today. Today is very different, though. It's a supply issue. Now, you have a lot of tax reform going on in the US, and one of the bigger parts of it is there's a tax break on repatriated dollars. So US corporates, like think people like Apple, which has this vast amount of offshore dollars, are now incentivized to bring these dollars home, you know, and use it for investment, but more likely it'll go into share buybacks and pay, you know, to pay dividends and the usual sort of thing. But ultimately, this means there's less offshore dollars available for unsecured lending. And that must mean, therefore, that the price of offshore dollar lending begins to rise. And that's why we're seeing the rise in LIBOR. So people are now just having to adjust to paying more for the dollars. It's not that people are unwilling to lend them. There's just less of them. And therefore, the price to borrow them has to go up to reflect that. Now, you know, you mentioned the TED spread. Another part of that, why that spread has been widening, has the fact that the US Treasury has been hugely increasing bill issuance to pay for the tax stimulus. Now, that also caused LIBOR-OS to widen. And that's obviously why you see the TED spread to widen. Now, they're similar things, because the main part that both have is the euro-dollar part means exactly the same as LIBOR. The OIS is obviously just where the Fed is. So you're just looking at slightly two sides of the same thing. LIBOR-OS, I would say, is the cleaner rate to watch, because the OIS thing, you know, at the base is ultimately the Fed's overnight rate compounded, and LIBOR is obviously the synthetic rate that banks lend to one another. But the key thing, I guess, to emphasize to your listeners is this is not an acute issue, but it is a chronic one, because LIBOR is still the reference rate for not billions, but trillions of dollars of loans. And effectively, you know, this widening in the spread, the LIBOR-OIS spread, has added almost 225 basis points hikes over and above the Fed's, you know, the Fed's already done 7 hikes since 2015. And this will increase repayments on consumer loans, mortgages, floating rate corporate loans, and it's going to squeeze bank margins as well. And, you know, if you look at the top right-hand chart on slide 12, higher LIBOR means higher household debt ratios. So debt ratios for households are going to rise. That's going to be a headwind for consumption. And also commercial paper rates have been rising, as well as the size of their issuance. And in the bottom right-hand chart, you can see that tends to lead to wider credit spreads. And at the same time, you've got these ultra-low rates that we've had for many years, interest coverage ratios for firms, rather than, you know, rising, as you might expect in a low-rate environment, had been falling. And this higher LIBOR will only make this worse. It'll only compound this. And so again, that will lead to wider credit spreads. And, you know, this corroborates what we're seeing from many of our other LEIs for wider credit spreads. You know, we have a whole suite of different structural indicators and some more tactical ones as well. And they're all pointing the same way to higher credit spreads and higher equity volatility. And the final thing to emphasize is this widening in LIBOR-OIS is permanent. You know, I mean, I don't think it's going to stay. It's now about 60 basis points. There's a very good chance it's going to come off a little bit and be a bit lower, but it's not going to go back to where it was in December, because this is a permanent loss of offshore dollars. And I think this is something probably the Fed wants. One of the big kind of accelerants of the financial crisis back in 2008 was all the European banks who'd basically been tapping US money market funds, getting these unsecured dollars and using them to buy heavily compromised mortgage bonds. So obviously when everyone stopped lending one another, because these mortgage bonds, you know, turned out to be, as they were, very bad kind of bets, you had this huge issue that caused LIBOR to spike extremely high. And the Fed obviously had to introduce swap lines. I don't think they want to be in that situation again. I don't think they want to allow people to get the same amount of leverage as they did back in 2008. So this is something that I think they want to see, this widening in the spread.
We have a fairly significant listener base in Canada, and I know that the Canadian macro outlook is a subject that you guys have written about for your institutional clients recently. Give us the update on how you see things evolving in terms of Canadian macro outlook.
So Canada, we've been looking at from the perspective of they have been getting dragged along essentially by U.S. Rate hikes, and they have had more aggressive rate hikes priced in than the US, even though, you know, our leading data for Canada has been turning down. So, you know, our view has basically been that the way to kind of look at Canada, and certainly from a trading perspective, is to try and fade those moves in Canadian rates. And obviously that means that leaves the Canadian dollar under pressure as well. So that's the kind of more the cyclical picture. Longer term, you know, we still have the housing market. You know, the housing market is still, household debt ratios are extremely high. And we have, you know, some of the egregious lending, obviously nowhere near as bad as to the extent as in the US, because lending standards are much more stringent in Canada. But you still have this huge amount of household debt overhang, which is a big structural issue. And that's something, again, I think we're going to look at. We've written previous thematic reports. I think we did one about 2 years ago, but we're going to do an update on that in the next 6 months.
Another topic on a lot of people's minds is China, and particularly a lot of people have predicted that the credit expansion there is caused so much excessive debt that when China's economy rolls over, it could get ugly. I think you're starting to see signs that maybe China's LEIs are looking lower. What's your outlook for China, and how does that relate to your outlook for commodities generally?
So China has been something we've obviously discussed a lot. We've built a number of structural indicators that tell us what probably now everybody knows, that in terms of a structurally bearish trade, you know, China is one of the best out there in terms of it has a huge debt overhang. But China are very good at managing that in a much shorter timescale. So, you know, that's why we focus on more of our cyclical leading indicators. And they began to turn over late last year, sort of mid to late last year. So we're seeing two things here, really. We're seeing economic leading indicators turning over, which points to lower growth. And we're also seeing liquidity tighten. And this is kind of part of an intentional strategy, a lot of it, by China. And now that President Xi has kind of solidified his position after the 19th Party Congress in October, I think they're going to allow themselves a little bit more leeway than they otherwise would in terms of lower growth, because they want to attack economic reform. They want to attack environmental reform. And they also want to kind of tame some of the more cowboy aspects of the shadow finance industry in China. So we're really seeing the effects of that manifest through. You know, when it comes to liquidity, the epicenter of where they've tightened is in the non-bank financial institutions, because they really are the origins of this kind of wealth management products, trust products, and all these other things that they now want to clamp down on. But, you know, no lending market operates in isolation. So some of that tightening has fed through into other rates. You know, lending rates have risen. We've seen CHIBOR generally has risen, and money growth has fallen. And all these things, again, point to a much weaker outlook in China. Now, we're not at the point of, like, you know, this is run for the hills time, but the indicators are all pointing in, you know, the same direction. They're pointing down, and they're pointing, you know, quite reasonably emphatically down. You know, we have the credit impulse has been turning over. That points to a weaker coincident outlook. So you have a situation where they are trying to fix things, but they're willing to accept more pain than they might otherwise would. And this has kind of been compounded as well by what's happening in the US. You know, US rates are rising. And whenever rates rise, it's obviously a problem for emerging markets, and it's a problem for China. Now, so far, the good thing is that dollars remain weak. You know, the dollars remain weak, and that takes the pressure off the RMB, and it takes some pressure off the capital account. You know, the FX reserves have been kind of growing very slowly. They certainly haven't been falling. The thing, obviously, to watch for a catalyst for that situation to worsen, and obviously China would try and lean against this, but, you know, they might wait until something worse happens, if you like, before they do that, it is the stronger dollar. And that, as I say, is, as you spoke about earlier, something that we expect to see at least in the medium term.
And you've also written recently about Japan, and I think you've observed perhaps that growth may have peaked there. What do you see going on in terms of the Japanese outlook?
So Japan is clearly kind of like a rolling over, but from a high level. So this is a situation where you have growth peaking, but is not turning down negatively so far. So that's kind of where we are with China. But they're in a better situation than they were certainly a year, year and a half ago, with the monetary policy outlook in Japan. You know, the Bank of Japan introduced the yield curve control policy, which was much more effective than the previous one, which was of negative interest rates. And the problem with negative interest rates was, when you have monetary policy, you need the banking system to help you transmit that monetary policy across the economy. Unfortunately, negative interest rates do the opposite. You know, the banks were essentially gumming up the yield curve control policy or instills a positive yield curve. And that then helps the banks, and then the banks can then help the easing monetary policy get out into the wider economy. So, you know, that's the positive backdrop, but the kind of more cyclical backdrop is we expect to see some more kind of slowing in growth. But the inflation picture is much better in Japan than it has been recently. So inflation in Japan is obviously that's the thing that they're trying to fix. But we now have signs that wages are beginning to pick up. And we also have for Japan, our wages leading indicator, which is also pointing to higher wages. And we're beginning to see that sort of trickle through into some of the inflation numbers. So it really is a case of the Bank of Japan kind of holding firm here. And I think one of the risk factors, by the way, that hopefully has alleviated was the scandal that Prime Minister Abe was involved in that caused his approval ratings to shoot right down. That would be hugely problematic because if Abe was to lose his job, then I think the whole reform program would be put into question. But however, that looks like something that's probably going to be okay and pass us by. And I think Japan's going to rumble along okay here. I think it's still one of the better developed market economies out there, especially if you want to look at currency hedged equities and things like that.
Simon, earlier you mentioned a report that you guys wrote called Understanding Market Tops, which needless to say is extremely topical right now. We have negotiated with your colleagues at Variant Perception to make that available to our listeners. They will need to go to the Variant Perception registration page and register their email in order to access it. Give them a sense of what they can expect to find in that paper.
Sure. So, you know, we've tried to create a systematic process at Variant Perception. That means that we, around the framework, we can then essentially package that and give people ideas about how we think. So we don't just talk about what we think, but how we think. And in that vein, we've written a number of understanding papers, one of which is called Understanding Market Tops. And, you know, as we discussed earlier, it's really about trying to identify how and what market tops have in common. And within that piece that people tend to really find useful is as a checklist for tops and all the different things, whether it's corporate leverage, whether it's economic leading indicators, whether it's the internals of the market or just overall bullish and bearish sentiment, which things that market tops tend to have in common. And overall, the piece gives a very good rundown of what market tops look like and how they behave, which, as you say, Eric, is very topical right now.
Listeners, you'll find a link in your Research Roundup email to a registration page at variantperception.com where you can register to access that report. Simon, I want to thank you for a fantastic interview. Patrick Serezna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Eric, what a great interview with Simon. You know, I found it really fascinating that they're already looking at this as a bigger topping formation in the market, which is something I also share in that view. But it's interesting at the same time they said that their recession indicators are showing no sign of a recession. And maybe you can help me connect the dots here, but at least naively, I've always connected that when you have a major topping formation, it's associated with recessions because a bear market is a revaluation of the whole market in one of those contraction phases. And I've never really known how to connect the dots when you have two different perspectives like that. What's your take on this?
Well, I think that, as Simon said, we're in a process where a topping process has begun. I definitely agree with that. But with the caveat that that could be a topping process where we still move to new all-time highs as high as, let's say, 3,000 on the S&P. I don't think it's at all out of question to see that. And I think that what will govern it at this point, and it's the reason it's so hard to guess what's going to happen next, we're out of the phase where finance professionals are making the decisions based on predictable behavior that you can anticipate with rational expectations theory. We're into that final phase of the bull market where it's all about retail investor psychology. As we see people probably panicking at exactly the wrong time, selling at the bottom, and then the market is racing higher, and we go, let's say it bottoms at, you know, 2450 or something, and then all of a sudden it's back to 26, 27, Are people then going to come piling in at 2,800 and say, oh my God, it's moving to all-time highs again. I shouldn't have gotten out. And are they going to pile in and because the fear of missing out? Or are they going to say, you know, once burned, I'm out, I'm not coming back? It's all about that psychology effect. And I think that it's been long enough since 2008 that memories of 2008 are probably not going to affect most people's judgment. There's a lot of investors in the market that were too young to have been investors at the time of that last big event. So I think it really is going to depend on investor psychology. I also think that if we see a backing up of treasury yields above 3%, particularly Julian Brigden told us last week about that 305 critical level on the 10-year. If we back up above that level on the 10-year yield, boy, that really makes it hard for the market to move substantially higher. On the other hand, if we saw that short squeeze in treasuries and the US dollar, it could really set the stage for a move to 3,000 or higher on the S&P, summer rally, and then the shit really hits the fan as we get into what is, from a seasonality standpoint, more typical crash months of September and October. And it usually, a lot of people associate October as the crash month. Generally speaking, it starts in September, and it's just October is the month that everybody remembers. But it usually the top is in August, and I think that we have a pretty good set of ingredients to get back to new all-time highs by August if we see that fear of missing out, people piling back in, if that investor psychology is, oh no, it's going higher. On the other hand, if we see treasuries back up and the recession comes sooner than anybody expects, then easily we could turn out that the top is already in.
Now, Eric, I want to get back to your conversation with Simon because you mentioned Russell Napier, and I wanted to talk about that and some of the inflation outlook. But we put together a chart book about the S&P 500, just again to give an update to our listeners. And I figured since you were just talking about the S&P, this is a perfect place for us to just touch upon this. And what we did again with that chart book was just again, we could give an update of where we are in this market correction on the template. And so when we go to chart number three, which was just the chart of showing the S&P 500 daily chart updated to today on April 5th. And what we can see is now we definitively have gotten a W. We've gotten a retest, and the retest took exactly 8 weeks, fitting the bill for what is a traditional market correction. When someone looks at this, then they're asking, well, why isn't that a double bottom? Why shouldn't we immediately start to buy here and just rip higher? And you alluded to that earlier in the pregame when you were talking about the S&P. And so what I did on page four was I put the kind of key technical levels that I wanted to talk about the S&P. Now, what I did here is I zoomed right in. We went to a four-hour intraday chart on the S&P futures. So every six candles is about 24 hours. And what was really interesting is you mentioned this idea of this 25-35 level on the S&P, which was very close to where the previous low is. And what's interesting is that that's a number that Charlie McElligott at Numera was talking about when it was featured as an article on Zero Hedge. And we put that link into the research roundup for any of you that want to read that article. But basically, Charlie makes the point that the 25-35 level on the S&P 500 is a level where CTAs go max short, and there could be a sell of as much as $100 billion of equities on the market. And he talks particularly about a clustering along those levels. Particularly, he mentions that the volume-weighted average price of the S&P for the year is around 25.39, and the year-to-date lows is the 25.32 level. It's all in the same range, effectively creating a stop loss where obviously many traders can get triggered and actually flip positions. And you know, this is a really interesting thing because we had this big bounce that happened just the other day, a big rally yesterday, and now we're approaching the top end of the retracement zones, and we're asking that very important question. Are the bulls going to show up to the party, rip through the retracement zones to the upside? Like if we had a rip of the S&P 500 up to like 2750, I think there would be no doubt that we'd have to start really calling the bottom is definitively in. But at the same time, we rejected the zone and trade right back to that pain point. A lot of crazy things can still happen. What's your take on this?
Well, I think we should start with what you just ended with, which is, why wouldn't you say that it looks like that test of the bottom is in and it's all uphill from here? It seems like, looking at this picture, that really is what it's telling you, is that you can kind of visualize where the trend line is on this downslope from that bounce up to 2800. We've broken out of that in the last couple of days and we're moving higher. So, gee, aren't we going back up towards a recovery from here? First of all, we haven't seen enough volume. And the reason that I don't believe it, if you'd asked me this question 2 days ago and said, what if it breaks higher? I'd say, well, if it breaks higher, maybe it's all over. The thing is, it did break higher and we're not seeing the volume follow through. So the question you have to ask yourself is, why are we not seeing the volume follow through? Why are the big boys not buying this stuff hand over fist, thinking that the final bottom is in? Well, Patrick, I think that Charlie's article, and Charlie is with Nomura, which is a fairly well-known firm, so this is getting the attention of institutional players, is very likely to be the answer. Now, for anyone who's a new listener who didn't hear our interview with Eric Peters, I highly recommend that you go back and listen to it, because he so eloquently explained this principle. When there is effectively a stop level in the market, and the example that he was talking about at the time is, everybody knew exactly what it was going to take to blow up the XIV ETF. If everybody knows exactly what it takes, the market will seek out and find that pain level, because there are people who are intentionally causing that event to occur so that they can profit from it. So you have to look at this picture. And what Charlie is saying in this article is that this red line here, this actual little range from 2532 to 38, that's where, if the S&P gets there, a lot of CTAs, that is commodity trading advisors, many of whom operate on software-driven algorithmic models, trend-following models, if the S&P gets down into that red zone, he believes that it is going to trigger about $100 billion worth of selling by CTAs, because they will have a signal in their algorithmic trading systems telling them it's time to go to their maximum short exposure, and they will sell about $100 billion worth of S&P notional exposure. Now, if you're a retail investor and you've ever had the misfortune of being a victim of a stop clearing run where a discount broker knows where their clients' stops are, and they basically gun the market up in order to take out your stops, and you end up being stopped out within pennies of where the move ended, and it retraces, and you ended up getting screwed. Imagine that's the mentality of the industry. Do you think the big boys who read Charlie's article and see that level down at 2535, and they say, we know if we game the market down to 2535, it is going to trigger a stop where the CTAs, which are all driven by software programs, no human discretion involved, are going to sell $100 billion worth of S&P futures, allowing us, and that's going to cause a major move down in price if that happens, as depicted by the red arrow here. If that happens and we trigger it, and then we get to buy, 100 points lower after the carnage is over, and then ride it all the way up to the top, are we going to forego the chance to do that because we're nice guys and we wouldn't want to do a nasty, dirty trick to our friends in the CTA business? Or are we sleazy Wall Street guys who live for this kind of thing? Well, you make up your own mind. The big question is, does Charlie have it right? Is there really a point at 2535 where, if it gets hit, all of the CTAs are going to go max short and sell that $100 billion. Guaranteed, Patrick, Nomura is a big enough player on the street that everybody saw this article. So what's happening right now is everybody is analyzing this, saying, is Charlie right about this number being what's going to trigger all the CTAs to go short? And if it is, I have to believe that some people are going to conspire to cause that to happen to the market. And that tells me the bottom is not in. And it's a perfect explanation for why we're not seeing volume follow through on what, from a charting standpoint, looks like a bona fide breakout to the upside in terms of the last 24 hours or so of action in S&P futures markets.
You know, Eric, and I wanted to add to that, because Bill Blaine from Mint Partners put out a piece yesterday that was picked up on Zero Hedge that basically gave a similar scenario, where he basically said that, is this the beginning of a new remorseless rise, he answered that as saying it's just another wave of the tide in the current cycle, and yesterday was driven by short covering. And he goes on to say that his stock-picking Chartist guru, Steve Previs, was basically suggesting that the corrective phase is actually not over, and there's still more pain to come, and it will resume. So there really is a two schools of people. The people that see the bottom that just occurred and think that there was the buy and dip, but then there is a no shortage of people who think there's still one more wave to come. And certainly we live in exciting times to find out what the next wave is. One way or another, for me, I think that we have to see over tomorrow and Monday's price action whether the bulls have any ability to follow through. Because as soon as the traders see that there's no more buying pressure on the upside, we will see it hit hard on the sell side. It'll be just interesting to see what happens over the next two trading sessions. All right, Eric, I want to go back to that interview with Simon, because you, in the middle of it, started touching on this whole idea of the dollar and bonds, and the fact that we continuously see this pattern of the US dollar declining and bonds declining and rates going up, and that this is not a customary thing for us to see. And you're always asking our guests, you know, why is this happening? And I have a question, and maybe you can help me kind of connect the dots on this. When I kind of look at this scenario, I see, well, look, a weaker US dollar naturally through the exchange rate pass through causes imported goods to naturally rise in price, and it creates a tailwind for CPI and consumer prices to go higher. And as we see that cyclical surge in inflation, it causes interest rates to have to surge a little bit higher and bonds to correct. So to me, I actually think there's almost like a feedback loop of the weaker dollar feeding a little bit of a tailwind to inflationary pressures, pressuring these bonds. What am I missing there?
Well, Patrick, I don't think you're missing anything in terms of that feedback loop. The question that I was asking Simon, that I've asked a lot of guests, and frankly, I've yet to really get an answer that resonates for me as fully explaining it, is the conventional macro wisdom is that when you have a country's real rate of return on its treasuries beating its competition, and for us, really, the U.S., the most important competition is probably German bund yields. So if we look at the real return on U.S. treasuries and the real return on German bunds, U.S. treasuries yield much more, and it's getting better. So you would expect that better yields attract more capital, and that you should see international capital flows that are looking for the best return on safe money to be moving away from German bunds into US dollars. That means selling euros, buying dollars. That should cause the US dollar index to increase, and particularly the dollar euro cross to improve in the dollar's favor. What we're seeing is the opposite of that. The usual macroeconomic conventional wisdom says that this can happen in emerging markets, because what's happening is the loss of faith in that country's treasury bonds is a bigger factor than this interest rate differential thing. But in developed markets where there is strong confidence in the value of that treasury debt, that they really believe it is safe money, it's not supposed to happen this way. And that what that says to me is there has to be an effect of the improving yields in the dollar over German bunds attracting international capital away from bunds into dollars, creating buying pressure on the US dollar and selling pressure on the euro. But what we've been seeing is there must be a stronger flow that is being caused by something else that is overwhelming that tailwind that should exist for the dollar. And what is that? What is causing it, and why is it happening? We've heard lots of comments from our guests, but I can't think of any of our guests who've given us a really cogent explanation of why is this time different? Why is it in the past, when we're talking about the US dollar, you've always seen as its real rate of return improves over other sovereigns that it competes with, it results in capital inflows into the dollar and appreciation of the currency, and it's different this time. What exactly is making it different this time? Now, I can think of lots of explanations that might be part of it. I haven't heard any one really clear explanation from anybody that just resonates for me and says, okay, that's the answer right there. That's the reason I ask the exact same question of so many different guests.
Well, you know, in that interview, you did mention Russell Napier, who just released a piece that we included in our research roundup, which is titled "The Fed's Ammunition Just Ran Out." And of course, it makes that argument that is not new, but it's the idea that too much debt and not enough money remain the diagnosis for deflation and not inflation. And it's this idea that from a money supply perspective, that back in November of 2017, 4 or 5 months ago, the level of U.S. bank credit adjusted for the acquisition of non-banks has posted no growth. And it's this idea that with a commercial banking system creating no money and a central bank that's destroying money, we're looking at one of the tightest monetary policies ever pursued by a central bank. And it's an idea that no one ever said it so boldly. But we have a scenario where high-powered money, the monetary base, is actually attacking bank reserves. And we're seeing that contraction, and credit is not being created. And and we're not seeing this big inflation surge. But yet, as Simon suggested, there is cyclical inflation indicators that are still showing inflation coming into the system. Well, how do we connect the dots to where this kind of all comes together?
Well, Patrick, I just love Russell Napier's writing style. He's so succinct and so clear. And the argument that he's making is between both the Fed reducing its balance sheet and also contraction of commercial banking assets in the United States. These things are tracked. They're not a speculation or a question that you might wonder what's going to happen to the dot plot with, you know, depending on Jay Powell, what he had for lunch next month. This is statistics that are known and measurable. The U.S. money supply is shrinking. There is a lot of money that is being extinguished in the U.S. money supply, while simultaneously, foreign central banks are creating money. So what Russell is saying is, how can you possibly think that destruction of money supply in the United States and at the same time simultaneous creation of money supply in other nations could possibly be inflationary for the U.S. dollar? And he makes a really strong argument. Now, the thing is, we've had other guests make very strong arguments, equally strong arguments, saying, look at what the data are showing us about the trend in inflation. So the question is, how is it possible when the U.S. money supply is in fact shrinking that we're seeing all these signs of inflation? What explains that? How could it possibly be? I don't know the answer. Maybe we need to get Russell Napier back on the program and ask him. But there's something going on here, and it doesn't make sense because the deflationary arguments, Russell just is so succinct in this article. I strongly recommend that everybody read it. Again, the link is in your research roundup email. How could it be that this is happening at a time when so many of our other guests have pointed out that they're really are 1960s levels of indications of an oncoming inflation when the data in terms of what's happening in the money supply just doesn't support it? And I don't know the answer, but something is amiss here.
Right. And what's interesting, he made a really bold statement as well. And there he goes, what everyone needs to know is that the U.S. dollar remains the world reserve currency and they have stopped making more of it. Right. And it goes on and just comes down to the point that the slowdown in money growth combined with the likelihood of a credit event in the offshore U.S. dollar credit market will mean that inflation fears can disappear rapidly. That is when the scale and attractiveness of U.S. real rates of interest will become apparent and the U.S. dollar will begin to rise. And I just think it's a really interesting pushback on what is pretty much a consensus view that inflation is the scary boogeyman right now. And we can really see him trying to take the other side of that story.
And I think he takes it incredibly well. The thing is, you know, maybe at some point we need to get the discourse between a Julian Brigden, who has a very strong inflation view, with someone like Russell Napier, because they both make excellent arguments based on data. These are both data-driven guys. They're looking at different data, and they're both drawing very strong conclusions, saying, look at this. How could anything else be right? Well, they both got good arguments. I don't know who's right, but I'd love to get to the bottom of this. But we've run out of time, so we're not going to get to the bottom of it this week. What we can get to the bottom of, folks, is if you could help us by forwarding your research roundup emails, telling your friends about Macro Voices. Use the donate button on our homepage if you'd like to help to defray our production costs and make the show possible. But please, most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com, because the more registered users we have, the more able Patrick is to negotiate to get the very best feature interview guests. The benefit of registration to you is that you'll receive our free research roundup email each week, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compilation of links to all of the coolest free stuff we could find, both our feature interview supporting materials as well as other cool research that we found on the internet, such as Russell Napier's article. Beyond Russell's article, what else will they find in this week's research roundup, Patrick?
So this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Simon, as well as a link to that variant perception presentation and chart book. You'll also find the post-game chart book where we discuss the S&P charts, as well as the links to all the articles we referenced in the post-game about the markets and inflation. You'll also find a link to a few articles highlighting the Canadian and particularly Toronto real estate markets, which have now legitimately crashed, as we now see the April 2017 peaks a year ago, in some cases house prices down 20-30% in the periphery. So rely of really interesting articles discussing that. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.